The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, landscaping expert and TV personality Brian Burke will be in studio sharing his tips for getting our garden deck and patio ready for the summer. Pete the Builder will be giving us expert advice on putting in a downstairs loo if you don't already have one. And Home of the Year winner Jennifer Sheehan and I will be debating those kitchen trends some of us love to hate. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the podcast, we love to hear from listeners during the week. You can email us at any time at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. And you'll find me over on social channels, Instagram and X. And I love hearing from people there too. Now, as the days get a little bit longer and the temperatures start to rise a little bit, it's time to dust off the garden furniture and get your outdoor space ready for, well, what we hope will be summer. But after months of rain, wind and cold, your deck, patio and furniture might need a little TLC. So where do we start? Well, I am joined in studio by RTÉ's super garden judge and Woody's DIY garden expert, Brian Burke. Brian, you're very welcome.
Hi, Sinead. Great to be here.
Good. And tell me, I presume you're all sorted now. Your garden's looking amazing. Everything's fantastic.
Well, I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. Believe me, it's that old expression, isn't it? The cobbler's kids are always the ones with no shoes.
Oh,
it's
right.
Similar with gardens, you know, the last place you address is your own.
Well, I feel better already, so let's get started. I have put down some bedding plants. I put down a little bit of mulch. I've done all that kind of bits and pieces to get it going. My poor old tomatoes, give them another go this year. But the one thing that I just can't bear to do is the patio, the cleaning bit. Do you know the boring bit, cleaning bit and the preparing bit? So tell me where we should start. For instance, let's start with if we have a wooden deck, because I know they can look lovely, but they can be hard to maintain.
Well, I guess it all depends on the type of deck that you have. So, you know, they're not all created equally. There's and the big division between them is softwood and hardwood. So What we're most familiar with and what is most typical is pressure treated softwood. And when I say softwood, I'm essentially talking about pine. Now there's spruce as well. Spruce is a softwood that's used in construction, but it's used more for screening, for fences, for pickets, things like that. It's not necessarily used below your feet as a ground surface. So pressure treated softwood is pine. Now, it's a little bit cheaper than your hardwoods, right? So your hardwood in a deck would be things a little bit more exotic. You get tropical hardwoods like Ipeh. Ipeh, Balao, you know, mahogany even.
What?
On
a deck?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, through the posh houses.
I mean, these are not as unattainable as it might seem, you know, but they're hardwood, right? What that means is they're going to last longer. They're going to resist rot for longer. So the pressure-treated softwood is the more affordable option, but that comes with maintenance headaches, and that's typically an annual thing. The level of maintenance involved will depend, again, to a large extent on the aspect. So if you're facing south and it's getting blasted with sun all day long, you're going to have a different set of problems than if it's, say, facing north and it's not getting the same extent of sun. It might be building up a residue of, say, moss or algae.
And it can get slippy, can't it?
Exactly.
And dangerous when it's like that.
Totally. So you're facing a different set of problems depending on, first of all, the type of wood you have and, secondly, the aspect. Now, treating a deck or getting it ready for the spring, like the jobs kind of fall into five categories, right? So there's cleaning, there's restoring, there's preserving, there's staining, there's oiling, and there's painting, right? And it all depends on what you want to achieve. Now, as a general rule, oiling wood or oiling timber is the best way to go because it penetrates the wood, it nourishes it, it preserves it. And it's a nice subtle way of going about it. Anything else is an opaque surface treatment. So a stain has a certain amount of varnish in it. A paint is an opaque surface treatment.
But it's just sitting on top.
Exactly.
Okay. So the oiling comes right down and actually mines the wood underneath.
Exactly. And again, the denser the wood, those exotic hardwoods I mentioned, they need a different type of oiling to your softwood. Softwood is more porous. It'll allow more oil to get in. So you can get a pretty commoner garden oil will do that. But if you have a hardwood deck, you need a slightly fancier version of the oil because it needs to penetrate that bit further. It needs to be less viscous.
Right. Now, I presume that's something your garden centre or your hardware store can deal with. But is this DIY work just with a bit of elbow grease and a kind of a power washer, or this is something that anybody can do just if they
absolutely
kind of have the tools.
And I mean, I mentioned cleaning and restoring, and in some ways they're a precursor to some of the other items. So if you have a heavy buildup of mildew, of moss, of algae, and as you say, it can make it render it slippy and quite dangerous, you need to remove that first. That's elbow grease. That's scraping that away. That's removing it. You can get a great product. You'll be able to pick it up down in Woody's, a Ronseal Restorer. So this is a treatment that you put on the deck. You brush it on, you leave it about 15 minutes, half an hour, and then you wash it off. And that will remove all that insidious residue, the buildup of material.
Oh, that's great.
You then allow that to dry for about 2 or 3 days. When we get days like we have in the last week or
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Nice,
of course,
bright
you never
sunshine.
Know, do you?
Allow it to dry and then put on your treatment. And that your treatment, depending on what you want, and again, this is an aesthetic choice as well. Some people like that bold colour. They'll put on a Cuprinol deck paint, like grey or something like that. Some people like just to use the oil to bring out the natural
colour. And it's a nice opportunity because the kind of the colour of the wood, the coloured wood now has become a thing. It's not all just that cedar or, you know, thing. So people are painting them teal and, you know.
There was a time you could have any colour you wanted as long as it was a shade of brown, you know, but that's totally different now.
It is.
You know?
Okay.
So the likes of Ronseal Cuprinol are doing specialised deck treatments. Now, be careful if you're selecting paint, make sure it's a deck paint. The paint that you're using for a screen or for a fence, that won't be able to stand up to foot traffic and that relentless scuffing underfoot. So it has to be
okay, paint. Good tip. Now, while we're on the subject of wood and before we get to the patios, is the furniture then the same?
Yeah.
Whether it's hardwood or softwood, it's the same type of treatment.
The same type of treatment.
Take the covers off and...
Exactly.
Do you need to sand them back or just...
In some cases, if you have previously applied a stain or a type of a varnish, again, that's a surface. That's something that will form and kind of a coating on the surface.
Yeah.
And it will degrade and just kind of disintegrate over time. So you need to remove that, get back down to bare wood. And again, all garden furniture is not created equally. Mm. The denser hardwoods, better quality, you need to oil them. And a good way to check if it needs to be replenished with oil is get a flat surface like the table, pour a drop of olive oil onto the table. And if it sits there, if it just sits there and beads and does nothing, the furniture is probably okay for oil. But if it spreads like ink on blotting paper, it's time to oil the furniture.
Oh, there's a tip now. Right, we'll all be doing that. Okay, now talk to me then about the stone or the stone tiles, because lots of people prefer those over the wood. Yep. They last for ages. But they can get, especially the paler colours, they can just get stained, you know, and mucky and leaves residue and pots sitting on them and all that. So is a power washer enough or do you need to go at them with a scrubber?
Well, again, it depends on the material, right? So the patios come in all types of material, all shapes and sizes. Again, depending on how much you want to spend, what your budget is. A lot of people go for precast material, slabs or smaller units like Cobblock.
Mm.
Now, they're fine, but they're precast concrete. So there's a porosity to the surface. So they will pick up a certain amount of dirt and residue, and that can be hard to shift. The way to overcome that is to seal it once you put it down. You can get a sealer with all of these products. It's like an acrylic sealer. It's a very robust version of like a polyurethane that goes over the top.
And does that mean then whatever lands on it is only on the surface?
Exactly.
And
it can be washed off. You see, there's a danger with power washing precast paving. Back in the day, we used to lay all our paving very tight. There was no joints. But the problem with that was that every drop of water that hit it had to be pitched to be moved away somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's kind of gone out of vogue now in time, factoring into this whole approach of urban drainage, sustainable urban drainage. We want our water to percolate down to avoid flooding. Our rainfall patterns are changing big time. So all of the paving you buy now has a little ridge, about a millimetre or a millimetre and a half, on the edge of it. And when you lay them, it forces them apart. So you get a 2 or 3 millimetre joint. That gets filled with kiln-dried sand or something like that, which is perfect for percolating and infiltrating water, but not so good when you go at it with a power washer.
Yeah,
because
I was
you
just
wash
thinking,
all that material out.
It's all gone. So that's not a good idea. So are you better off getting one of those big yard brushes and then scrubbing it that way kind of more gently?
Now, you can use a power washer if you're careful. Right, it is possible, but a bit of elbow grease and a good J's 4-in-1 patio cleaner, very good product for just general purpose cleaning. Bit of elbow grease, replenish, and if you can, a bit of sealer. Now, if you have porcelain or tile or something a little bit more elaborate like that, you can power wash away because the surface of that is not porous. The joints are all sealed. They're typically laid to within 2 millimeters of each other. The joints are grouted.
Mm.
And then you can typically just use your power washer gently.
And the water just rolls off.
And the water rolls off.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. So once we have the cleaning and the maintenance and that done, or we've supervised somebody else doing it, which is usually the case in my house, then we're on to the nice stuff and putting down plants. Brian, what trends are you seeing in gardens at the moment? What are people getting in? Now, we had a whole time when there were hot tubs and there were, baths down the back and those heaters, underneath the umbrellas. What kind of things now are people liking?
What people are still liking, and the popularity of them has kind of sustained itself for a couple of years, are covered spaces. So the idea of a modified version of a pergola. So we all know the idea of a pergola originated down in, the Mediterranean countries. Mm. The idea was that it would allow you to sit outside. You could train a climber over the top. You were sitting outside, you were out in the air, but you were shielded from the blazing midday sun by a beautiful wisteria.
We don't really have that problem.
We don't have that problem, but we want to kind of adopt the architectural feature that a pergola is, but we had to modify it for our climate. A balmy summer's night, it might be 19, 20 degrees, but it might be drizzling. You still want to sit under a pergola. So we're putting polycarbonate, perspex, things like that on the roof of them,
So it's like a kitchen extension in one sense. So it's like maybe that portion taken up so you could keep furniture on it without having to strip everything off every night.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a practical thing, And some people put them onto the back of the house at the double patio door there. And some people go further down into the garden, make it a destination down the far end of the garden, Fire pits are still popular.
Right. Now, are we talking about the ones, because I know you can get them in supermarkets now, and they sit on kind of cross legs. Are you talking about the ones embedded or types?
Both, all types. Okay. The simple kind of standalone ones that you can move around, they're still popular. Also, the built-in features, as part of a more elaborate approach to maybe a sunken patio, you'd have a centralised fire pit, with a sunken element, sitting around with waterproof furniture, again, underneath your polycarb covered pergola.
There's something kind of very primal about having a fire pit with all the power. But I do know from being around one a couple of times that if the wind gets up, you have to be a little bit careful there, don't you? All your guests end up with sooty faces if you're not careful.
Absolutely. I mean, there's certain evenings they will suit more than others, But again, these are all attempts to just allow us to spend more time. Like, it's an acknowledgement that our climate doesn't always suit, And all of these little things, these little features and accessories are attempts to allow us or facilitate us to be outside a bit more in the evening.
Fantastic. All right. You've inspired me. I'll get going with it. You have to get going with yours as well now, of course.
Absolutely. I'm on it.
That's brilliant. All right. Lots of lovely ideas there. And folks, get in touch with us if you have any ideas of things you'd like to do in your garden, or maybe you've planned it or you're about to launch it this season. Do let us know, 53106, or find me over on social media, Instagram. Love getting your pictures, and you can check me out there. Brian, what's next for you? Telly beckons or?
Yeah, I mean, Woody's Budding Gardeners has just launched, so we're going to be busy with that. That's the fifth year of that this year. It's our annual initiative to get primary school kids involved in gardening. You can enter as part of your school or as part of your family at home. So all the info there is on the Woody's website.
Fantastic.
If you search for Woody's Budding Gardeners, you'll find that. So that's going to keep us busy.
Brilliant. Great to get them involved early. And are you on Instagram, Brian?
I'm not, would you
believe? What?
I'm probably the only one, am I?
A TV personality not on Instagram. That's a first for the home show. All right. Well, listen, it's lovely to chat to you, and the best of luck with all of that that's going on in Woody's and elsewhere with you. And thanks for coming into the home show.
Thank you, Sinead.
Now, if you're thinking of squeezing in an extra loo under the stairs, converting part of your garage into a bathroom, or putting it somewhere else in the house just to give you that little bit of extra space to alleviate the morning rush or get in a guest bathroom, what is actually involved? What will it all cost? And how do you go about it? Well, who better to ask than Peter Finn, better known as Pete the Builder. Peter, very welcome back to the Home Show.
Hi, Sinead. How are you?
Good, thank you. Now, this is a kind of one that we come to from time to time when we're looking at expanding things in the house. And it's usually, you know, a kind of converting a home office or sticking out an extension in the kitchen. But it can be very, very practical to have an extra loo, especially if you're in an older house or one of those that don't automatically come with a downstairs loo. Do you think that people do this often, or is it something that people look for, Pete?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think you summed it up there by saying it's a very practical thing to have in your house, because sometimes in a home, the only toilet is upstairs. So rather than having guests or kids, if it's a busy house, having to go upstairs to use the toilet or the bathroom, you can have your downstairs toilet. Also, if it's a busy house and there's a lot of people living in it, it allows somebody to use the bathroom for, you know, having a shower, as well as there being the facility for somebody to use the toilet downstairs. So without a shadow of a doubt, it's certainly something that people do consider doing when they have the space under their stairs is usually the location that gets picked out to get it done.
Indeed. And I'm also thinking of people, maybe older people with less mobility, who want the extra space downstairs. And I know there are grants and all sorts available for this kind of thing. So that would be something that would be very useful as well.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, if you are somebody that's getting on later in years or has had a disability for whatever reason, again, having a downstairs toilet is something, yeah, it makes absolute sense to do that. It's usually a tight enough space, so trying to shower is for washing downstairs is not as easy. That can usually lead to some sort of a small extension out the back, and that's usually where the grants start kicking in. But again, without a shadow of a doubt, if you have the opportunity to take advantage of that space, it has multiple functions and creates a lot of options within the home.
Okay, now would there be a minimum space that you'd need to work with before, to know that you could actually fit everything you need in there?
Yeah, so, you know, the two things that you're trying to fit in at a bare minimum, obviously, is your toilet and then your hand basin, so for washing your hands. So you can do it in lots of different formats and lots of different ways. Now, look, there are wheelchair accessibility issues and that type of stuff as well, but if you're just literally trying to squeeze this in to create more space for, you know, everyday use and for people who don't have any disabilities, well, then you need to use at least the width of the stairs, which is usually somewhere between 800 and 900 millimetres. And then approximately, if you can go 1.2 to 1.5 metres in the opposite direction, that gives you enough space to be able to have a door in the middle. You can walk in, you can have your toilet on one side, and then your hand basin on the other.
Yeah.
Again, it's usually a small size hand basin.
Yeah, because you want to be able to stand up, sit down, turn around and put in the towel rail and the loo roll holder and all that kind of thing, and maybe a picture or something like that. Okay. Now, talk to me about the plumbing challenges involved. I mean, can you put this anywhere, or do you need existing pipework?
So if you have existing pipework, that's your best case scenario. But unfortunately, in most situations, that is not the case. So If you're under the stairs, let's say, and your stairs is on an external wall, that can also help as well. Because if you are in a semi-detached situation and you're able to go out to through the side wall, and then try and tap into storage, which again may be out in your side lane or your path outside. If you don't have that, you're then the biggest issue that you have then is trying to get your drainage from that location to connect into your mains. So it can be quite tricky, and it certainly is something that you do need to do some exploratory work on. And unfortunately, it's not a one-fix-all situation. Like, pretty much every house and every layout of every house is going to be slightly different.
Yeah.
If it's been done, if you're living in a housing estate and it's been done in your housing estate, well, then that's usually a good sign that you can do it in your house as well. Mm. But again, you know, speaking to the general masses here, you really do have to investigate your own situation. And you're looking for two things. You're looking for your mains pipe to get out, and it has to be a 4-inch sewer pipe that you need to use to get your toilet needs to go out.
Yeah.
And then also you need a hot and cold supply. You only need a cold supply, obviously, to your toilet, but you do need a hot and cold supply.
Of course, to come in. So there's a lot there because, you know, this certainly isn't DIY territory now, as far as I can tell.
No,
you need... Well, talk to me then about planning permission, because you're talking there about putting things out and putting things... Like, I presume you don't need planning permission if it'll all fit under the stairs.
Yeah, no, you absolutely won't need planning permission unless you decide that you want to put a window... to get daylight into the under the stairs. But then you are looking for planning permission. But in my opinion, if you're just looking to put in a toilet for practical uses, you're not materially changing the exterior of your house, so therefore you do not require planning permission.
All right. Now, what would happen if you had a garage attached to your house and you said, you know what, I'll build the loo in there because it'll give me more space, or kick it out through that wall? Is that possible?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's taking advantage of an existing space that's there. Again, like, sometimes that can be a very practical way of doing this project, but it really does depend on your routes that you need to take to get your sewer connection made. And then, obviously, you know, like, if you're on the ground floor, you're going to have a hot and cold supply to your kitchen sink as well. So usually that's the location that people will try and take the hot and cold supply from.
Yeah.
Your sink only requires 1.5-inch waste pipe. So again, if you're at an exterior wall, you can go out through the exterior wall and you can go surface with it. It's your 4-inch pipe that causes more complications. Now, there are sani flow systems where, you know, the sani flow system will macerate the waste from the toilet. And
it's like an airline loo, is it?
Yeah, very similar. It's usually used in basement locations or attic locations sometimes as well. But if you're on the ground floor, you would normally try and connect into your main sewer and just use a standard gravity flow then to work your sewer system. So again, the two things that you're looking out for is you need to find your sewer route or your foul route on the exterior of your house. Then you need to map a route from your location of your new toilet, and then you need to do the same thing again for your hot and cold. Obviously, you're going to need a light in there as well, so you need some electrical work as well. So there's a little bit to it, you know.
Yeah, there obviously is, and that's before you go out looking for, you know, a nice hand basin and some fluffy towels. Now, listen to me, Pete. I'm going to ask you another question that builders don't like answering.
No, it's coming next.
What's all this going to cost? You've built me up now to tell you know, it's not easy. It's very complicated. You need a specialist. Go on, give me the bad news. For the tiniest room in the house now.
Yeah, I know. And like, I suppose like your cost for your, like, you can buy a decent toilet and a decent hand basin for a couple of €100, being totally honest with you. You know, that's not a large cost.
Yeah.
It's mainly going to be your plumbing cost that's going to be the large cost in this project. And again, it depends on your distance that you need to travel. Like, you could, like, in the best case scenario, go straight out through the side gable of your house and connect into your mains outside. So there's a good bit of Kangol work involved. There's definitely some sewer connections to be done. And obviously that needs to be done correctly. The last thing you want to be doing is creating a sewer problem or a blockage in your...
Go on, you're avoiding the question. give me a figure.
There's no one figure I can give you.
All right.
That would suit every situation. But I suppose if I was to put a guesstimate on it, you're talking somewhere between €6,000 and €8,000 in total, I would imagine. Again, depending on distance and depending on the complications.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's too much to get going without having the advice and without knowing what you're doing. Because, I mean, you know, if you have to go a long way and you have to put in the extra pipes and it doesn't hook up to the existing systems, it's obviously going to cost much, much more than that. And that, I mean, that's before you get to the nice stuff, Pete, like tiling and painting and all that.
And remember, you know, every meter that you are angling a track for your pipe, you could be going through existing finishes, which then need to be put back as well, you know. So it's not a simple job. If you are lucky enough that you do have those connections, and even luckier again that maybe when somebody was building their home, they put in these services, that then you're talking much less cost and much less hassle.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, that's great information to have. Just, you know, because you can't get the sense, oh, it's only a tiny job because it's only a tiny room. But of course, there's so much more involved than that. Come here to me. Yeah. Are you finding that people now, the latest trend with all the bathroom isn't just a downstairs loo, it's a wet room or a mud room. Are you finding much call for things like that at the fancy end?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, pretty much any renovation that we're doing or upgrade of a home, predominantly it's wet rooms that we're putting in. And again, the technology, when they first came out, the technology wasn't great in them, and it was a little bit new to the market, and you used to get some issues with leakages and stuff like that happening. Mm. But nowadays, the tanking systems are so good and so robust that once you put in your wet room tray, so it basically will come like a tile backer board tray that will have the slopes in it and all. You can get linear waste and you can get circular waste, you can get square waste. You can really, you know, there's a lot of options. Mm. And again, then you tank directly from that tray onto your wall and then you tile afterwards. So it is a very robust system that does work and they look absolutely class. Yeah. They really are very, very, very slick.
And you're not going to do that now for a couple of grand either, are you?
Well, it sounds a bit funny, but if you have, especially if it's upstairs, again, you're only talking about a 2 inch or an inch and a half waste pipe, so you don't have the complications that you have with a 4 inch pipe for a toilet.
Okay, so that might be the better option then if you have the space and move on and spend the money on your fancy bathroom upstairs.
Well, there you go. And again, as I said, like, you can buy these units off the shelf. They come with the waste trap and everything built in. They're very robust and they look great, and they again, usually the tiling that goes with it as well. I suppose the two come hand in hand. Mm. They're designed in a way that you can then tile them and they look really well and function really well afterwards. So there's no doubt about it. The wet room is certainly a big success if it's done correctly.
Yeah, we love the old bathrooms in Ireland. I mean, they're, you know, I'd say if you ask somebody when they're building a house or whatever, what do you want? They'll be like, bathrooms everywhere. Everyone needs one.
Absolutely. With a nice bit of pressure in your shower, because again, you're going to use it pretty much every day of your life. So yeah. I do always say to people when they are investing in their home and doing renovation, especially in the main bedroom, you should, without the shadow, without
putting
in a nice ensuite if you can.
All right. Listen, great advice, Pete, as always. And hope all is good with you and continued success in all you do. That's Pete the Builder, otherwise known as Peter Finn, with some bathroom advice there. Now, this April, the Royal Institute of Architects and Simon Open Door campaign celebrates its 20th year in collaboration, with over 1.4 million raised today to help tackle homelessness in Ireland. For a €120 donation to the Simon community's members of the public can book an hour-long consultation with a registered architect. Well, here to tell us more is Maura Henry of DHB Architects. Maura, you're very welcome along to the Home Show. This thing is always ferociously popular. It sells out very quickly every year.
Well, thanks, Sinead, for having us and giving us a moment to share our experience and to promote this great event. Yeah, it is very popular and it's gaining in popularity, which is terrific because it's supporting Simon, who do such great work combating homelessness in Ireland. And for anybody who doesn't understand what it is, we, the architectural community, offer our services for free to people all over the country who are interested in finding out more about what they can do with their property, be it an old house, a new house, a barn in the countryside, at different levels of their design stage. And we happily spend an hour with people. And these people kindly donate €125 to the Simon community. It goes directly to the charity. We don't get paid. We do it on a voluntary basis. We're very happy to do it. So it is gaining in popularity because people, I suppose, are becoming more familiar with the type of work architects do and what positive change architects can bring to their project of any scale. So perhaps for that reason, it's gaining in popularity.
Indeed it is. And tell me, what are the common queries that people come to you with, and what they need to have done before they consult with you? Because, I mean, I presume you don't want somebody just to present a blank sheet of paper and say, knock yourself out, bill me something. Do you recommend that they have a very specific set of questions in mind? Because an hour isn't an awful long time, but it's enough to get a good steer on something.
Well, good preparation always helps, but we will deal with anything. We will even deal with the blank sheet, because I do understand that for a lot of people, it's new territory. But for those who have the time, it's useful to maybe send in advance an aerial a location of where their property is, so that we can get an idea of the context, the orientation, whether it's a house in a rural setting or in an urban setting. If they have any drawings that exist of the building, that's helpful too. But we won't turn anybody away. Equally, if people, there are so many government initiatives at the moment to support different types of energy upgrades to houses, or, you know, even taking over vacant properties. We hear a lot about that on the news. So if people are able to even look at the various websites where there, you know, where there is already information about these schemes, I suppose they themselves will be more armed and be able to ask more pertinent questions to their particular area.
Okay, so it doesn't matter really if they don't know everything at this stage. It's just to help provide that scaffolding for them.
Absolutely.
Maura, what role do you think architects can play? I mean, I'm sure you, along with everybody else, would say you wish this was not needed still, because homelessness is still a big issue for us. Where can architects help, or maybe collaborate even with the state in tackling some of the issues that we have?
Well, that's a big question. And I'd like to think that the architectural community, certainly through the ORIAI and its various expert committees, are working hand in hand with the state on a number of these issues, particularly housing. I suppose as architects, we're trained to provide shelter. And that's what we've been doing for the last couple of hundred years. And we have a skill set that helps us provide the best value for money in terms of shelter for housing. We can provide, you know, we can design quality spaces for quality budgets. We can equally design very large scale projects for enormous budgets. Mm. But we do have a skill set to work with, context, materiality, clients' needs. And we have a creative streak that we've learned that we can blend all those things and provide perhaps the most beautiful solution with the most efficient use of funds. As a community, as I said, we work hand in hand with a lot of government departments. I myself was part of the Taoiseach's task force looking at Dublin City Centre. I went there on behalf of the ORIAI. Mm. So we, and I'm not alone, there are many others in the ORIAI who work to promote best practice in everything to do with architecture with the relevant government bodies. So we do have a skill set to help with the housing crisis. And indeed, there are some very, you know, very, very good architects doing some very, very good work.
Well, Maura Henry, thank you so much for bringing us that information on the Simon Open Door campaign. And if people want to find out more about that, there is a website you can go on, and that's to book your time slot with an architect, €125. And the website is RIAI simonopendoor.ie. Bit of a mouthful, RIAI simonopendoor.ie. And the registration is open now and will continue until all the slots are filled, and then in April you will go and consult with your architect. Maura Henry of DHB Architects, thanks a million for joining us today on The Home Show.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Sinead.
I am delighted once again to be joined by Jennifer Sheehan, former Home of the Year winner, and this time for a debate. Now, I hope we're not going to fall out.
When do we not?
True.
We always end
we
up
like dissenting opinion on News Talk, and in particular on The Home Show. But we are going to talk about, we're staying in the kitchen.
We're here for hard topics.
We are. And we are going to talk about trends. And like even the word trends, you know, some people are like, yeah, but they come and they go, and the kitchen is an expensive place, and I don't want to be kind of waiting and stuff. And then some stuff lands and it stays for years and years. So we're going to talk about a few things that we may differ on. We may disagree respectfully. I won't throw anything at you. I don't think. I'm not near.
I think you're right. Like trend, the word trends gives me hives, but humans love change, don't we?
We do.
We love change. We
do.
We are who we are.
And it's a nice thing to swap up and change out and all that kind of thing. Yeah. Now, the first one we're going to start with, because these are all kitchen things that people love or they hate. The reason I want to start with this one is because I've totally changed my mind on it.
Oh.
So this is kitchen cabinets and the colour of them, because I was always one that said, no, have white, have cream, you know, stay with the neutrals. Mm. You know, it goes with everything. You've loads of cabinetry and it should all be that colour. But actually, the more kitchens I see and the more kitchens I'm in where they're going with painted wood, lovely teals and black and, you know, purples, I actually absolutely love it.
I love it too. And it's, I wouldn't even call it a trend. It's around forever. Coloured kitchens, you know, they're here to stay. I have a coloured kitchen. My kitchen is Railings by Farrow and Ball and I love it. I'm not sick of it at all. I will say though, there's been not even a trend, but a movement overall towards organic materials, natural shapes, all that kind of stuff. And with that comes a movement towards natural wood kitchens, you know, that kind of matte look, maybe a little bit stained, varnished and stained. Not that kind of highly varnished look that we had for a long
time. Yeah, like nearly like an industrial look to that kind of natural paired back wood.
Yeah, exactly. Really natural. Yeah. Really raw.
So both are okay.
Both are okay.
I what's not okay, I suppose, is the kind of the old Formica front things or the very old
things.
Or the pine wooden.
Really knotted,
cupboards.
Really yellowy, too varnished, I don't like. And I don't love, you'd often find, you know, that really super, super kind of high gloss kitchen that's actually usually a wrap. And then a few years later, you know, the steam from your kettle starts to make it peel off the sides and it can happen.
So we're all right. Okay, so both are okay. We're going with that. 50-50. Right, okay. Whatever you have has worked. Now, the next one I'm bringing up because I found a trend in America, where else, for wildly curved kitchen islands.
How wild are we talking?
Well, it was like a kind of an 8.
Oh, no.
Do you know?
No. That's not for me. What, like an infinity kind of thing?
Yeah.
It's like a V thing? In
yeah.
The and people were just,
yeah.
No.
And just
Thank
kind
you.
Of, it just looked a bit just odd.
Yeah.
but it seems that all kitchen islands are not the same and they're just not coming in that kind of rectangular piece with the hob or the sink in the middle of it.
So a bit of a curve, I'm all for it. I think it's so nice. It's really comfortable to sit at. It's, you know, you're not banging your hip when you're moving through the kitchen. And it does fit if you have a slightly unusually shaped kitchen. It just means you can fit something a bit different in there as opposed to your big plonking rectangle of a kitchen island that used to be just stacked in the kitchen. So a nice little gentle curve, I'm all for it.
Okay.
I did do a little online research in preparation for how I felt about these trends and I saw some weird kind of like convex curves.
Right, yeah.
No.
You see?
No.
And I think that's just maybe kitchen designers or architects, look, we have to have a splash feature. We have to have a wow factor, even if the wow is wow.
Right. And I think the one kind of downside you can have to a curved kitchen island is you might be sacrificing a bit of storage space because you're not going to have your standard unit. But you can still have a curved countertop and who cares if you sacrifice
Okay.
it.
Okay.
It's just so nice.
Okay.
I'm here
this is going
it.
Well.
We're going,
yeah. Right. Okay. Now, while we're on the counter, one thing I have in my house, and I'd love to get rid of it, is a big extractor hood. And I mean, very often, obviously, they have to go over where the hob is. My hob is on the island and there's this big metal hood hanging from the ceiling. Look, I don't really see it anymore, but it really is huge. And I'd love one of those ones that where the extractor fan is built into the hob and all the air gets sucked down rather
than over. The downdraft extractor.
But there are lovely extractor hoods.
So there are lovely extractor hoods. They're just not for me. I'm all for the downdraft extractor. Now, I understand if you're somebody who's super into your cooking and you've got your gas spider burners and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
A downdraft extractor is not something you can have, right? It's fine if you have your induction hob and you're going to have to put your hood overhead and that's fine. I've seen a trend where people are kind of turning these into statements, and we've got tiles and we've got metallics and we've got all sorts of
copper,
different colors and copper. That's, and I just, it's too big and gaudy for me, and I just don't
really
love it.
See, I'm of the opinion that if you're going to have something big and ugly anyway, you might as well go full bling with it.
While I see where you're coming from, I disagree. What I do like is I've seen this lovely look, the very kind of organic-y shaped kitchen where the hood is just plastered into the wall almost. So this lovely curve comes out of the wall and then curves back in again. And
you kind of have to plan that at the beginning though.
Oh yeah,
you?
Yeah. It's not a retrofit.
It can't be not a retrofit. Okay. Now, another thing which might cause a little bit of dissent and consternation, because I am a hard pass on benches.
What? What's wrong with benches?
Well, what's wrong with chairs? That's why they were invented.
One person per chair, multiple people per bench.
Okay, so you're at a dinner party. You have somebody on either side of you, and it's like being in the middle seat of the middle aisle on a plane.
Ah,
like, excuse me.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be sitting there in the first place if you only had chairs.
Scoot up on the bench there, love.
You'd be like, I'm sorry, we actually can't have you over for dinner tonight because we only have four chairs. We should have gotten benches.
Yeah, I know they work in I know they work in small houses and they're great for storage, and you've done items on that before.
And I love the coziness of that. I like
there's something
that.
Big country cottage about it that it just doesn't fire me up. That's all. All right. Now, another thing that possibly doesn't fire you up, because I've heard you talking about it before, the backsplash, and we've done whole shows on the backsplash, the tiles and making your own and painting them up and the wood and the steel and all that. But the acrylic, big, big feature, big trend, coloured acrylic backsplash. Very clean, very hygienic, gorgeous pop of colour.
Right. I have to tread carefully here because my mother, who is a fabulous woman and has never done anything wrong, has a lovely backsplash in her kitchen, and it's wonderful. I do like a statement backsplash. There's many statement backsplashes I like. Would I pick up an acrylic one in my own house? I don't think.
So it's the material that you don't like rather than
I
the colour.
It's the colour, but that I think it's the colour. Because I'm here for a statement tile. I think it's the colour. Yeah. Okay. Do you know what I love is a mirror, big mirror backsplash. I think that looks great.
Ah, would you go away?
I love it.
You're going to spend your whole day. I have a mirror on the whole opposite side of my kitchen, nowhere near the cooking bit, and it gets splashed and
yeah,
there's
but
marks.
It's so easy to wipe clean. It's going to get splashed. It's a backsplash. But there's no grout in a mirror.
I'm for the acrylic backsplash. I don't have one. I covet one.
Okay,
I will
get one. I get a mirror.
Dead simple. Right. Smear free.
See the benefit.
And then finally then, the one thing I do want to talk about, and this will be a yes or no because people love them or they absolutely hate them. I love them, and they're crittle doors.
Now,
describe a crittle door, Jenny,
crittle
for anybody
door,
who doesn't know.
The second I start describing it, listener, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. It's these glass doors with the black square panes in them.
Correct.
And
they're thin. They go to the edge of the thing. You don't need your architrave and your moulding and all that.
And the original crittle has different window panes. There's crittle style where you kind of slap on what looks like a frame. What I will say is, while I might personally be a bit sick of them, the absolutely fabulous Jerry O'Toole, Jerry Designs on Instagram, put up brass crittle doors on her Instagram recently.
Next generation.
I am obsessed. I'm fully back on the crittle door bandwagon if I can have those brass ones.
You can.
Thank you.
You can. You can. This is the home show. You can have anything you want.
Brilliant.
Jennifer Sheehan at Workers Cottage on Instagram if you want to find her and all her fabulous ideas and storage and the bench. And it's lovely to see you again, and we'll see you next time you're in. And that's all we have time for on the show this week. If you'd like to drop us a line, it's thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over on Insta and on X. And I want to thank this week producer Aisling Lynch, Jack MacDonald, Stephen McLoone was on sound, and we will all be here next week to do it all again. Have a lovely, lovely week, and we'll see you next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.